lineage. The den was a carpeted fort, a boy thing. It smelled like beer, glue, and semen, and Catherine did not personally see the appeal. Walking around the room, she shrank from the mess and the tins of half-eaten food. She wiped the tears from her face and sniffed.
"How long have you been here today?"
"Dunno,"
he said, pulling a discarded coat from a mouldy heap in the corner.
"She bluttered the dregs of the christening whiskey by lunchtime."
He held the dry overcoat out to her. Catherine stepped out of her good green coat and slid into the man's Harris tweed. It smelled of lanolin and sweat, but the crispy dryness of the rough wool felt good. Leek took an old biscuit tin from the shelf above the girly pictures and handed it to her. They sat together on the homemade sofa. He put his arm gently around her and climbed inside the coat till they had an armhole each. Catherine lifted fingerfuls of the sweet cake from the tin. She could taste the amber sugar of the syrup her granny was fond of. It made her feel better.
"I haven't eaten anything today. There was no one to cover the phones, and Mr. Cameron said he would bring me in a sandwich when he got his own lunch, but he didn't. And, well, I didn't like to say, or else he would know he had hurt my feelings."
"Feelings are for weaklings."
He was using the Dalek voice she hated. Catherine drew her head out of the collar and looked at him coldly.
"Well, hiding is for cowards."
The long, shy eyelashes fell low on his pink cheeks. Ever since he was a boy, he had been easy to hurt. She drew her arm back inside the mothy coat and wrapped it around his back. She could feel his thin ribs through his school jumper.
"I'm sorry, Leek. It's terrifying coming out here to find you. I'm wet and I was afeard. And now my new boots are ruined."
"You can't keep anything good around here."
She pulled him to her, 2 years younger and already a foot taller. She buried her damp crown in the crease of his broad chin. She let herself cry quietly and tried to let the anger she felt for the Neds and their fishing knife bleed out of her.
"Have you been hiding here all day?"
"Aye."
His sigh ran through her.
"I told you. She woke up and I could tell over the cartoons that there was a belter coming. She was shaking something terrible. So she asked me to watch the wain while she went out to the shops."
He trailed off. She knew he was staring into the distance.
"Did she take a drink in a pub?"
His eyes had glazed over again.
"No, I don't think so. She had the whiskey. Then I think she got a carry out and battered some in the lift back up."
"Well, it is very dry up at that altitude."
Catherine licked the last of the sticky mess from her fingers and put the tin down.
"Aye, she seemed fair parched,"
he said sadly. There was a long silence between them. Leek took out his top set of porcelain dentures and rubbed at his cheek as if they had been pinching. Agnes, annoyed with the constant trips to the dentist, had convinced him to have his teeth, weak and riddled with aluminium fillings, pulled for his 15th birthday.
"Do they still hurt?"
Catherine asked, grateful that her teeth were still her own.
"Aye."
He flicked the slabber from the plate and put it back in his mouth.
"I'm sorry, Leek, and I'm sorry I left you the day."
She gently kissed his cheek. It was a tenderness too far. He put his hand over her face and held her away from him.
"Get off me, you minger! Besides, don't ever feel sorry for me. I'm done feeling bad about this shite."
Leek unbuttoned the oversized coat and stepped back out into the cold. He pulled the sleeve of his black school jumper over his knuckles and wiped his sister's kiss from his face. Watching him, Catherine thought how Leek would have looked 12 had it not been for the large Campbell nose. She watched how his long fingers, as delicate and fine as a clockmaker's, worried it, ran the length of it constantly, fidgeted with it, measured it, and then regretted it. He lowered his hand from his nose.
Stop gawking!
He stepped out of the lamplight into the dark side of the den. Catherine picked up a black sketchbook. Leek had been drawing again. She flicked through the pages, holding intricate sketches of bikini-clad beauties sitting on top of a muscular Ferrari or astride winged wyverns. Leek's was as good as any rock album artwork, a beautifully rendered world of shy fantasy. The muscles and sinew and naked beauties eventually gave way to precise, ruler-drawn plans for architecture and woodwork, technical drawings for futuristic buildings and smaller, more thorough ones for record player units, and one for a homemade easel. There wasn't a minute she could remember that he didn't have his pencil in hand. She was smiling proudly to herself when Leek emerged from the darkness and snatched the sketchbook from her.
I don't see your fucking name on it.
He lifted his jumper and tucked the book into the waistband of his denims.
Leek, I think you're very talented.
He made a raspberry noise and disappeared back into the darkness.
I mean it. You are going to be an amazing artist, and I'm going to get married, and between us, we're both going to get the fuck out of here and away from this dump.
The hissing came from the dark.
Fuck you. I know you're going to leave me. I've seen you making eyes at that orange prick. I know that you're going to leave me to deal with her on my own.
Leek, can you not stay in the light where I can see you?
No, I like it over here.
Catherine dried her hair on the coat sleeve and thought for a moment. She pushed back against the fear the Neds had left inside her.
Shame. I'm here to take all my clothes off and wrestle a giant winged snake for you.
He stepped from the darkness, shaking his head.
Don't bother. I prefer to draw bigger tits.
Catherine flinched, but she said,
use that imagination of yours.
I don't have a pencil fine enough to render their intricate miniature reality.
They glowered at each other with serious expressions. Catherine made the dry boak face first and pretended to throw up all over the old man's coat. Leek copied her until they were swimming in imagined vomit. Catherine watched her brother's shy smile return, and she thought how it was a shame he didn't do that often enough anymore. Leek caught her searching his face.
Take a picture, why don't you?
Catherine tried to soften her gaze, afraid she might send him back into the shadows.
So did Mammy look in a fighting mood, or more of a maudlin mood when you left her?
He shrugged.
She was on the phone most of the day looking for Shug. I could just tell it was going to end badly.
How comes?
She was drinking like she wanted to get somewhere else.
Was she loud?
He shook his head.
More sad than loud today.
Catherine sighed.
Fuck. We better get back. I think there's been some trouble.
No way. I stole enough food to stay here the night.
He was halfway back to the dark already.
You'll catch your death of cold.
Good.
Come on, Leek. You're a bit bloody old for a Wendy house.
It was a mean thing to say, and she knew she wouldn't win if she continued in this way. Her brother had been gifted with legendary stubbornness. He just stared through you and floated away, leaving behind his frame to be pecked to pieces. Catherine didn't want to face their mother alone. She did not want to walk back through the darkness without him.
Please, I came to get you. I didn't give your glue-sniffing pals a look at my skirt for nothing.
She bit her lip pitifully.
You have a fishing knife, Leek. They grabbed my tits.
Leek looked very angry then. She was always scared and secretly delighted by the sudden force of his temper. It always came quietly and brutally, and the smallest slight could turn horseplay into horsepower.
Please.
Her arms went limp by her side in a gross pantomime of helplessness. Being pathetic was not in her true nature. Leek went back into the dark corner of the cave and returned with his hooded anorak and the broken handle of a garden shovel. He turned it menacingly in his hands. He put out the smoky camping lamp, and together they climbed quietly back up the hole and out on top of the pallets. Leek slid the trapdoor shut, and they stood looking out over the glistening city below. It was beautiful. Catherine lifted her right hand and pointed into the darkness far beyond the orange city lights. "Leek, do you see that over there?" she asked. It was a line of emptiness in the horizon, black like the edge of nothing. He followed the line of her finger. "Nope."
"There,"
she said, and pointed harder, as if this might help. "Look past Springburn and Deniston. Look past the very last scheme."
"Calf, just because you make your arm go stiff, it doesn't help me see any better. It's pitch black. There's nothing there."
"Exactly." She considered this before lowering her finger and turning back towards the high-rise.
"That's where I overheard Shug say we were flitting to."
Chapter 6. Agnes had lain with fits of coughing and hacking most of the night. Now the morning light that was pushing in through the curtainless window would give her no peace. She could no longer ignore the wet draught that was pushing into the room and down onto her clammy body. Opening her eyes, she searched the room feebly for a solution to this nuisance. Her eyes hadn't expected to find the black fingers of soot. She had bolted upright in a panic before she recognised the burnt bedroom as her own. Like a terrible postcard from the night before, her reflection stared back, fully dressed, with a face full of spoilt makeup. She looked at the pillow behind her and at the wet blue mess she had left there. Her gaze shifted across to Shug's side of the bed. It hadn't been slept in. Agnes lowered her chin back to her chest and tried to clear her blackout. The correct images wouldn't come. Running her fingers through her black curls, she felt the crispy brittleness of too much hairspray. From habit, she placed her head in her hands and dug her nails sharply into the hairline, feeling the poisoned blood flush to her scalp. It felt good. The memories of the previous night started to ring like large chapel bells in her skull. Clang! Here is the wane dancing on the bed. Clang! Here is a flame on the curtains. Clang! Here is Shug, twisting his wedding band with a face full of disappointment again. Agnes lay back in bed. She sobbed, but it was the self-pitying kind that brought no tears. She thought about holding the wane down as the flames raced up the curtain. She pushed the memory away and willed herself not to look at it again. Yet the more she looked away, the more it blossomed like a terrible flower. The guilt sank like dampness into her bones, and she felt rotten with the shame. She searched for a cigarette to coat her sore throat. It felt as black and sticky as tarmacadam in July. There were no cigarettes left in the room, and no matches either. She had been placed under surveillance. This at least cheered her a little. Out in the hallway, the house was quiet. It must have been late enough, because the door to her parents' bedroom was open and she could see their bed was neatly made. She went into the windowless bathroom and closed the door, sitting on the toilet. She thought about taking a bath and sinking to the bottom to wait for the Lord. In the tub were two sodden bath towels, badly blackened by fire. She couldn't bring herself to move them. Agnes wrapped her lips around the cold metal tap and gulped the fluoride-heavy water, panting and gasping like a thirsty dog. She began to wipe the ruined makeup off her face. The cotton wool came away blackened with soot stains. Opening the medicine cabinet, she searched the plastic shelves for Willie's medicine, something to take the edge off, but the painkillers were gone. She lifted a bottle of congealed cough syrup and took a mouthful, and then she took another. When she finally emerged into the dark hallway, She stood for a long time arranging herself. In the dark, she tried on different smiles. Small apologetic ones where she lowered her eyes and looked up through heavy brows with tight trembling lips. She tried some light casual smiles, like she was just back from the shops. She tried a large, toothy, beaming smile, a gallus head nod that said, "So what? Fuck you." If Shug was in there, this would be the one she'd wear. Willie and Shuggy were sitting at the round dining table eating soft eggs and soldiers. 60 years apart, they were huddled together in the far corner like old drinking pals. Leek was upended on the settee, his bare legs up and over the back, sketchbook in hand. When he saw his mother, he got up very quietly and passed her with a polite nod, like a stranger in the street. All the windows were thrown open, the house already scrubbed with bleach. The air was bitter and sharp. Willie turned his head back towards his eggs when he saw her. He must have been at early mass. His good suit was folded neatly over the kitchen chair. He sat in his undervest, his thick arms a tapestry of faded blue ink from his wrist to his shoulder meat, names and places never to be forgotten from the war. A laughing, black-haired girl from Donegal, and Agnes's own name and birth date in proud, elegant letters. "You've missed mass." Agnes tried several faces and finally decided on contrite. She heard sniffling in the kitchenette. "Is Shug here?" she asked nervously, a grin breaking over her false face. Willie shook his head. It had all been too ugly for him. The fight, the fire, the Wayne crying. He pushed his glasses up his nose and stared deeper into his eggs. "Please don't grin, Agnes. Please don't smirk at me like that." Her son, God bless him, had lit up like the Blackpool illuminations when she came into the room. Shuggy's eggy hands were outstretched towards her, a bath towel tied around his head like a turban.
"Mammy, Catherine wasn't very nice to me this morning. She said I was a sook."
Agnes picked the boy up. He wrapped himself around her sore bones, squeezed the life back into her.
"Granda said I can have 3 empire cakes a day."
"You, come back over here and finish your breakfast, or there will be no cakes."
Willie waved a thick hand at the boy, and with a sullen tut, Shuggy slid down from his mother's trunk. She felt the shaking in her bones start again. Her father shoveled a mouthful into Shuggy's pursed lips before he spoke again. His voice was measured, but his eyes would not meet hers.
"I know it's my fault, Agnes. I know I'm the reason you are the way you are."
Agnes shifted in irritation.
"Not this again."
Her throat was desperate for a smoke.
"Hear me out. I know I spoiled you when I should have given you that belt. I know I'm sentimental, and I know I'm soft. But you have no idea. No idea what it was like."
Willie rubbed the meat of his fist across his lips. He looked to the door of the kitchenette like there was someone off stage feeding him lines.
14 of us there was. My old ma saw none of them get what couldn't be earned by their own hands. Not even our baby Francis, with his twisted leg. Poor wee bastard had to fight and shove like the rest of us. So when your mammy tells me I'm to be blessed with you, I pray to let it be different. I promise that you'd never know want the way I knew want."
"Daddy, please. You don't have to.
Where were the fucking cigarettes?"
He cracked his rough hands together. The sound was like booming thunder.
"Am I always to be a milksop in my own house?"
He was not a man who raised his voice. Agnes buttoned her lip. Even Lizzie stopped her sniffling in the kitchenette. Willie Campbell was a man built for loading granary barges down on the Clyde. She had seen him single-handedly clear a pub of a half-dozen disrespectful Liverpudlians.
Every day at 5:15, you'd come running down that road to meet me as neat as a new pin. I asked your mammy to make sure you were clean. She used to say to me, Willie, is all this palaver really necessary? But sure, it was the only thing I ever asked her to do. A man needs to take pride in his family. But people don't care about things like that anymore, do they?
Willie's tattooed knuckles were knitted together in anger.
It gave me that much pleasure just to be proud of you. I could tell they were jealous, hanging out of their windows with tight faces. Grown men and women, jealous of a wee shiny bit of life like you. I used to laugh when they said you'd be ruined.
You did good, Daddy. I was happy.
Aye. Then what have you got to be so unhappy about now?
He sucked at his teeth and placed his hand on top of the boy's head. The weight of it looked like it might buckle Shuggy's neck. There were sentimental tears in Willie's eyes, but he was watching her coldly, like it was the first time he had seen her properly.
So tell me, Agnes, am I to belt you?
Agnes's hand went to her throat. She felt like she might laugh.
Daddy, I'm 39.
Am I to beat this selfish devil out of you?
He rose slowly from the table. His arms were loose at his sides, his hands massive silt buckets at the end of iron cranes.
I am tired of you coming first, Agnes. I am tired of watching you destroy yourself and knowing it's my fault.
Agnes took a step backwards. She wasn't smiling anymore.
It's not your fault.
Willie closed the living room door quietly. He drew his heavy granary belt from his wool trousers. The Meadowside Union logo was debossed into the leather, and the sheer weight of it dragged on the carpet.
Aye, maybe it's for the best.
Agnes held her hands out and backed slowly to the door. The gallus grin was gone from her face. As her father advanced, she kept walking backwards, until she felt the living room cabinet at her back and heard the glass-eyed ornaments tinkle in warning. The boy was at her legs now, his head hidden halfway behind her denims. Willie twisted the belt around his hands, once, twice, for a better grip.
Put that way and away from you.
She held the boy closer. Willie folded his hand around her soft upper arm. With his other hand, he separated the boy gently, but surely from her leg. He led Agnes over to his chair, where he sat down and pulled her over his knee. She didn't struggle, and no more begging words would come.
Lord Jesus Christ, I ask you to give me the strength to forgive.
The union belt came down with a loud crack on the back of her soft buttocks. Agnes did not cry out. Willie raised his hand again.
I thank you that my burden is never more than I can bear. Crack! Show Agnes the many blessings of her life. Crack! Quiet her needs. Crack! Show her some peace.
There was a soft shuffle at her side, and Agnes felt her left hand be taken up. She felt the cooling of bloodless hands on the back of her clammy neck. She felt the gentle stroke of her mother. Lizzie knelt on the floor by her side. Her voice joined Willie's in prayer.
Lord, it is only through your forgiveness that we can forgive ourselves.
Crack!
After the fire, Shug had gone out on the night shift, and for the second time that week, he hadn't come back in the morning. Besides his brother, Rascal Bean, and a few boys at the taxi rank, he didn't have many male friends. Still, Agnes knew, there was a million other places he could happily be. She sat gingerly on the edge of their bed. The backs of her legs were scalded red from Willie's belt, and she couldn't concentrate as she folded Shug's clean socks, one inside the other, matching the faded hues together exactly as he liked. Whose arms would he be in now? She felt the fight inside her begin to grow again. Could he be as close as the next tower block, with Big Rini? She had to get out. She had to show face. From the linen cupboard, she picked up one of the folding deck chairs they would take to the Fairweek caravan. She took out and rinsed her dentures under the warm tap. In tight denims and wearing her new black bra as a bikini top, she went out into the landing and waited for the piss-stained elevator. When she made it down the 16 floors, she was relieved to see there were no burnt curtains lying around. Except for petrified dog shit and some faint scorch marks, the forecourt was empty. Agnes checked out back of the tower block to see if Shug's taxi was parked there. She had caught him out like that once before. When he was supposed to be working a day shift, he had been upstairs fucking some unknown wifey. His sweaty shenanigans had been separated from his family by a few feet of council-grade concrete. Agnes had ridden the St. Hill elevator all that afternoon with a mop bucket full of cold tea dregs and piss. She waited at each landing for the doors to open on him and called off the hunt only when they opened on a group of bonny young girls who were going outside to play. The children took one look at her and fearfully refused to get in the lift with a mad-looking woman from the 16th floor. At first, she had thought how stupid Shug was to get caught out so easily. Only later, when she confronted him, did she learn that she was a stupid one. He hadn't been caught out. He wanted to make sure she knew all about it. Some things were not to be missed. The sun was white in the sky. The concrete was already vibrating with the morning heat. On the waste ground, Lizzie was sunbathing on an old blanket with her back against the foundation. Her floral dress was open to the breastbone and pulled apart to make the most of that rarest of occurrences, sunshine. Her hair sat in tight baby blue curlers and was carefully wrapped in a gingham tea towel. She was reading the day's paper and gossiping with a clutch of old deers in the patchy grass. The other women sat in a cluster of kitchen chairs and were peeling the skin off big brown potatoes and dropping them into an old plastic bag. Agnes set her deck chair a respectful distance from her mother and her gang. Lizzie barely looked up from her paper, and Agnes knew she was being punished. She tried to settle herself casually into the warmth of the sun, but her eyes kept flitting to Lizzie, wanting only a sliver of friendship to ease the loneliness in her chest. There was new graffiti on the wall above Lizzie. It sprang like a dirty thought bubble from her curls. "Don't be shy, show us your pie." To Lizzie, the graffiti could have been a helpful plea to a bashful baker. Agnes knew better and couldn't help but laugh. Lizzie scowled at her.
"What do you find so funny?"
It was the first time she'd spoken since the front room chapel that morning, and Agnes took a moment to consider whether she felt like encouraging it or ruining it.
"Nothing. Where's my wee man?"
Lizzie answered as spartanly as she could.
"At the baker's, getting his cake."
She went back to her paper. Agnes knew the routine. Saturday and Sunday afternoons, Willie walked with his grandson the half mile or so to the shops. It was a scant row of half-shuttered storefronts set into a shadowed recess that never seemed to catch the daylight. They had dragged families out of the old Glasgow tenements for this scheme, and it was meant to be different, futuristic, a grand improvement. But in reality, the whole scheme was too brutal, too Spartan, too poorly built to be any better. Shuggy would stand well-behaved inside the packy shop while his granda bought a noose of sweetheart stouts and a half bottle of whiskey, enough to carry them through Saturday night and discreetly through the Sabbath. The growing boy gave Wally and Imran something to talk about as the bags were loaded with the alcohol. It was a routine in which neither man was allowed to acknowledge the drink moving between them, as though it would have broken the charade. Across the shadows, inside the bakery, Willie would make small talk with the pretty girls while Shuggy greedily eyed the cakes. Shuggy always chose the same bright pink sponge pyramid, covered in red and white desiccated coconut and trimmed with a sugary sweetie on top. He would walk home very slowly in Willie's shadow, enjoying his spoils. Agnes looked in the direction of the shops, but couldn't see them. She rose and stood on the edge of the waste ground. In her black bra, she threw her head back and stretched her arms wide to enjoy the sun's tingle on her pale skin. She caught a sideways glance from Lizzie. There was the start of a puce bruise on her lower back. It was this that held her mother's attention. Agnes's ringed fingers traced the belt welt, and she winced dramatically. Lizzie stiffened proudly and hissed, "For the love of God, cover yourself!" The women peeling potatoes exchanged a sympathetic glance that said they knew how bruises could be more plentiful than hugs in a marriage, and not just for the women. Agnes was not to be told. Irritated now, she collapsed into the deck chair again and bounced it gracelessly like it was a child's space hopper, bouncing, bouncing, till she was sat closer to her mother. Agnes sprawled out luxuriously, her skin already poaching to a light rose colour. She reached out her foot and played with the hem of Lizzie's yellow floral dress like a child. Lizzie lowered her newspaper and pushed Agnes's foot away.
"Stop fussing with me," she said. "You've got a cheek to show your face around me this morning."
Lizzie undid the tea towel wrapped around her curlers. She opened a plastic bag at her side and started unravelling her hair. Agnes took her mother's pick comb and slouched in the sticky deck chair again.
"My head is throbbing."
Lizzie drew out a curler and held the Kirby grip between her lips.
"Oh, poor you. I hope you don't expect any sympathy."
"You should have stopped him."
Lizzie was watching Agnes out the side of her eyes now.
"Milady, let me tell you, in 40 years of marriage, I have never once seen your father raise his hand in anger."
She turned to the woman with the potatoes.
"You know, Maigret, he's that soft, I thought he'd come back dead a week into that bloody war." "Aye, he's a fine man, right enough."
The potato woman nodded in unison. Lizzie turned back to her daughter.
"I don't want you dragging his good name down with your own."
Agnes ran the pick through a painted tangle.
"Am I that low?"
"Low?"
Lizzie scoffed.
"Do you know, I've just been sat here on my lonesome getting a wee bit of colour, and I've no been able to get any peace from anybody. A woman can't even run her messages, but she's got to cross this grass and ask me how I'm holding up. People should mind their own. I'm just after having Janice McCluskey drag her mongoloid son across these weeds to me. She goes, 'I've heard your Agnes has no been keeping that well. How's her wee problem?'"
Lizzie's knuckles were white with indignation as she twisted a Kirby grip.
"I'm sat here with my dress unbuttoned down to my God's glory, and that pair of mouth breathers gawping down at me. Ignore them, mammy. Bastards. No keeping well. No fucking keeping well."
Her hands clawed at the imagined offenders in front of her. Lizzie exhaled loudly, and her anger shifted to a look of tired defeat.
"I don't deserve their hand-wringing, Agnes. I've worked hard my whole life without a day's rest, and for what?"
Agnes knew the next line well enough. Agnes still shook her head.
"So you could have everything you ever wanted."
Lizzie seemed so far away then. Agnes had the urge to wrap her mother in her arms, beg for her forgiveness, even though she felt not a shred of remorse.
"Can we be pals again?"
"No. It's not as simple as that anymore."
The corners of Lizzie's mouth turned down in a mocking way.
Let's just kiss and make up.
No, I think not.
She uncurled another clump of hair.
How many women will it take, Agnes?
Agnes bristled.
I need a cigarette.
You need a lot of things,
then she added.
You should have stayed married to that Catholic.
Agnes rooted around in her mother's curler bag. She took out the embassy packet and put two cigarettes in her mouth. She took a long draw and held the smoke inside for a long while.
Jesus can't pay my catalogue.
Lizzie gave a fake laugh.
No, but hell will mend you.
Agnes got up then and sat on the blanket by her mother's side. The lit cigarette was a measly peace offering, but Lizzie took it and said,
Help me take out these curls. I must look half mental.
Agnes took her mother's head in her hands and ran her fingers through the thinning hair. Lizzie softened slightly.
You know, your father always used to come in on a Friday night, 6:30. Every other working fellow on the street would go missing. There wouldn't be a man's voice till Sunday afternoon, not in all of Germiston. I remember that you could hang out that window and watch them all stow home on a Sunday tea time, all of them addled with a drink.
The potato peelers were nodding in unison again. Lizzie said,
I'm no judging the men. That was just what they did in those days. If you wanted your housekeeping money, you had to go dig your man out of the pub on a Friday tea time. But your father would come singing Friday night, his wage packed in his hand and a fresh parcel under his arm. Silly fool would have been down that market on his way back from Meadowside and picked up a wee dress or a new coat for you. I never knew a man know the size of his wains, let alone go shopping for them. I used to tell him to stop it. He was spoiling you. But he would say, What's the harm? Mammy, I can't talk about this again. Honestly, I was that happy for you when you married that Brendan McGowan. He seemed like he could give you what your father had given me. But look at you. You had to want better. Why shouldn't I? Better?
Lizzie used her clenched teeth to itch the tip of her tongue.
Look where better has gotten you. Selfish article.
Agnes brushed out the last of her mother's curls. She had to restrain herself not to give them a sly tug.
Well, seeing as you think I'm selfish then, I need to ask you for a favour.
Lizzie sniffed.
It's a bit early in our friendship to be calling in favours.
She rubbed the lobe of Lizzie's ear gently, manipulatively.
I need you to tell him for me. Tell him that we're moving. Will you do that?
It'll kill your father.
It won't.
She shook her head.
But if I stay here, I know I am going to lose him.
Lizzie turned and studied her daughter closely. She stared coldly at the flicker of hope in Agnes's eyes.
You will believe anything, won't you?
It wasn't a question.
We just need a fresh start. Shug says it might make everything better. It's only a wee place, but it's got its own garden and its own front door and everything.
Lizzie waved her cigarette airily.
Oh, la-dee-da, your very own front door. Tell me, how many locks do you suppose this front door is going to need to keep that wandering bastard at home?
Agnes scratched the skin around her wedding band.
I've never had my own front door.
The women were silent a long while after that. Lizzie spoke first.
So, where is it then? This front door of your own?
I'm not sure. It's way out on the Eastern Road. It used to be rented by an Italian chippy or somebody Shug knows. He said it was very green. He said it was quiet. Good for my nerves.
Will you have your own washing line?
I would think so.
Agnes rolled onto her knees. She knew how to beg for what she wanted.
Listen,
We're pals again, right? I need you to tell my daddy for me.
Your timing is beautiful, after this morning's nonsense.
Lizzie pulled her chin into her chest and made a long, low clown mouth.
If you leave, he'll blame himself to his dying day.
He won't.
Lizzie began rebuttoning her summer dress. The buttons were lining up wrong, and it was testing her patience.
Mark my words. Shugbane is only interested in Shugbane. He's going to take you out there to the middle of nowhere and finish you for good.
He won't!
Willie and Shuggy came lumbering across the forecourt then. Lizzie saw them first.
Look at the state of that. A walking advert for soap powder.
By the time Agnes looked up, the last of the Eiffel Tower was being licked from between the boy's chubby fingers. She couldn't help but smile at her father, the giant with his shirt tails untucked, like a schoolboy shirking his uniform. They walked slowly, swinging between them the Daphne dolly that Shuggy treasured so much.
If you can't make Shug do right by you, at least make him do right by the boy.
Lizzie narrowed her eyes at her grandson, at his blonde dolly.
You'll be needing that nipped in the bud. It's no right.
Chapter 7. Agnes followed Shug's red leather cases as they migrated around the flat. They had shown up out of nowhere earlier in the week, with no price tags and the faint look of having been gently used. Shug had neatly folded all of his clothes, setting socks within shoes and rolling underwear into tidy jam rolls, before packing everything thoughtfully inside. Often, during the week, he would open one of the red cases and study the contents closely, as though memorising the inventory, then close and lock it securely again. Agnes could see the cases were half empty, that there was still valuable space inside. Several times she left small piles of the children's clothes near them and then watched with bubbling jealousy as the cases up and moved to the other side of the room, still with nothing belonging to her or the children placed inside. On the day of the flit, he had set the red cases by the bedroom door. Agnes worried the suitcase lock with her nail. She wondered why she hadn't seen the new house herself. Shug had come home with the idea after one of his night shifts spent talking to a Masonic pal who owned a chippy in the city centre. A council flat in a two-up, two-down that he said had its own front door. Shug signed for it there and then with all the casualness of buying a raffle ticket. Agnes wrapped the last of her glass ornaments in newsprint and lined up her old green brocade cases next to Shug's. She intermixed them, rearranged them, but no matter what she did, there was a sense that they didn't belong together anymore. In the luggage tag that hung from her case was a handwriting she barely recognised now. It was the happy, confident loops of a much younger her, running away from her first husband for a promise of a life that was worth living. Her fingers traced the forgotten name. Agnes McGowan, Belfield Street, Glasgow. When Leek was still in nappies, Agnes had run away. On the night she finally left, she had packed the green cases full of new clothes, showy and practical things she had bought in the last of Brendan McGowan's tick and had kept hidden for the past long year. Before she ran away, she had scrubbed their tenement flat one last time. She knew the news would bring in the neighbours. With beady eyes, they would pour in to offer condolences to her man, hoping to gnash their gums at her uppity ways. She wouldn't dare give them the pleasure of thinking her slatternly, too. On the plush hall carpet, she had tamped a loose corner with her toe, pushing it back in place, and she was sad to hear the crunch of carpet tacks grip the wood once again. Earlier in the day, she had tried to lift it. She had broken two good wedding spoons and bloodied her fingers before sitting back in frustrated tears. As the mascara ran down her face, she had wondered if maybe she should stay on,
just a little longer, just till she'd gotten good use out of that new Axminster. She hadn't tried to take everything, but that carpet was new, and she had enjoyed how the old wife across the close blanched every time she saw it. It was a kind of hall carpet that you left your front door open for, the beautiful thick kind that you wanted all the neighbours to see. She had nagged and nagged until she got it installed, wall to wall, Templeton's double Axminster. But the tingly feeling hadn't lasted this time, not even half as long as she had expected it to. Living with the Catholic, in the ground floor flat, all she could see was a wall of grey, soot-covered tenements across the street. The night she ran away, Agnes had watched the lights go out, one by one. Good, hard-working folk getting an early night for an early start. Outside in the rain was the purring hum of the Hackney engine. She could not help but feel some excitement, and inside her, underneath the doubt, was a rising thrill. Over the back of the sofa lay two miniature effigies, studies in neat Melton and soft velvet and uncomfortable shoes of patent leather with gaudy silver buckles. She woke her sleeping toddlers. Catherine looked like a drunken old man, her sleepy eyelids opening and closing in big distressed gulps. As Agnes kissed them awake, there was a low scratch on the tenement door. She crept out to the hallway. The door opened with a low whine, and a man's round, tanned face twitched anxiously in the bright tenement light. Shug moved impatiently from one foot to the other, ready, it seemed, to run at any moment.
"You're late," Agnes hissed.
The smell of sour stout in her breath made him swallow his half-smile.
"I don't fucking believe it." "What do you expect?" she hissed. "My nerves are shot waiting for you."
Agnes pulled the door open and passed the heavy cases to Shug. They bulged at the zippers and tinkled happily, as if they were full of Christmas ornaments.
"Is that it?"
Agnes stared at the deep, swirling carpet and sighed.
"Aye, that's it."
With the cases in hand, the man shuffled into the street. Agnes had turned then and looked back into the flat. She went to the mirror in the hall and ran her fingers through her hair. The black curls bounced and folded back on themselves tightly. She ran a line of fresh red lipstick across her mouth. "Not bad for 26, she thought. 26 years of sleep. In the children's bedroom, she finished making the beds and put the dirty pyjamas into the pocket of her mink coat. Without negotiation, she gave them each a single toy to bring and led them out into the hallway. Stopping in front of the big bedroom door, she turned to them. She looked at the lovely carpet and in a low voice urged,
"Right, no matter what, no crying, all right?"
The shiny heads nodded.
"When we go in there, do you think you can give me a big, big, happy smile?"
She found the bedroom switch through habit. It flicked on with a click, and the dark burst with bright, unflattering light. The room was small and tight, dominated by a Rococo-style bed that was much too large. The boy happily called out,
"Daddy!"
And the messy hump in the royal bed stirred. Brendan McGowan sat up in shock, blinking at the Victorian caroler stood at the foot of his bed. His mouth went slack. Agnes pulled the collar up on her mink coat in a grand gesture. It was a coat he had bought for her on tick, an unnecessary extravagance that he had hoped would make her happy and hold her at peace from want, if just for a while.
"Right? Thanks for everything then."
It was coming out wrong.
"I'm away,"
she said, in a clumsy understatement, like a maid who had finished her chores and was leaving for the day. The sleeping man could only blink as his waving family filed out of the room. He heard the front door close gently,
and the heavy hum of a diesel engine. Then they were gone. As they roared away that night, the black Hackney taxi sounded solid and heavy as a tank. Agnes sat in the long leather banquette flanked by her warm babies. The four drove in silence through the wet and shiny Glasgow streets. Shug's eyes kept glancing in the mirror, flitting over the faces of the sleeping children and tightening slightly.
"Where are we going then?"
he asked after a while. There was a long pause.
"Why were you late?"
asked Agnes from behind the collar of her coat. Shug didn't answer.
"Did you have second thoughts?"
He stopped looking in the mirror.
"Of course I did."
Agnes brought her leather-gloved hands up to her face.
"Jesus Christ."
"Well, didn't you?"
"Did it look as if I did?"
she replied, her voice higher than she would have liked. The streets of the East End were empty. The last pubs were closed, and decent families were tucked in together from the cold. The Hackney pulled along the Gallagate and drove on through the market. Agnes had never seen it empty before. It was usually full of people buying their messages or new curtains, nice bits of meat or fish for a Friday. Now, it was a graveyard of empty tables and fruit boxes.
"Where are we going to go?"
"I left mine at home, you know."
He was glaring at her in the mirror.
"We agreed. We said a fresh start."
Agnes felt the hot heads of her children burrowing into her side.
"Yes? Well, it's not that easy."
"Aye, but you said..."
"Yes? Well..."
Agnes fixed her eyes out the window. She could feel him still staring in the mirror. She wished he would watch the road.
"I couldn't do it."
The man looked at the children in their Sunday finest, old-fashioned clothes worn for the first time, expensive clothes bought for a midnight escape. He thought about all their clothes neatly folded in the cases.
"Aye, but you didn't even try, did you?"
She fixed her eyes on the back of his head.
"We can't all be as heartless as you, Shug."
He tapped the brakes as his body spasmed in anger. All four of them lurched forward, and the children started to gripe.
"And you fucking asked me why I was late."
Bits of spit landed, gleaming on their rearview mirror.
"Why I was fucking late was because I had to say goodbye to four greeting fucking Waynes."
He drew the back of his hand across his wet lips.
"Never mind a wife that threatened to gas a lot of them. Tell me if I left her that she would put the oven on and not light the ignition."
The taxi screamed off again. They drove in silence, watching empty night buses grumble by and dark windows on cold houses. When he spoke again, he was quieter.
"Have you ever tried to walk to the front door with your bastard and family stuck into you like fish hooks, eh? Do you know how long it takes to peel four screaming Waynes off your leg? To kick them back down the hall and shut the door on their wee fingers?"
His eyes were cold in the mirror.
"No. You don't know what it's like. You just tell Muggins here to come get you. You sally out with suitcases like we were off to Millport for the day."
She was sobering up. She stared silently out the window, trying not to think of the trail of fatherless children and the childrenless father they were leaving in their wake. In her mind, it looked like a trail of viscous, salty tears being dragged along behind the black hack. The excitement had left her by then. When they had passed under the Iron Railway Bridge at Trongate for the third time, the sun was starting to rise and the fresh fish vans were being unloaded at the market. Agnes stared at the women crowded at the bus stop, the early shift charwomen getting ready to clean the big city centre offices.
"We could go to my mummy's new flat," she had mumbled finally. "Just till we find a place of our own."
All these years later,
Agnes didn't want to think about that night because it made her feel like a fool. Now she had packed the Catholic suitcases again. These brocade cases that were now carrying her away were the same ones that had brought her here to her mother's. She looked down on the green cases and ripped the old McGowan label in two. After Agnes had left the Catholic, Brendan McGowan had tried to do the right thing by her. Even after she had stolen away in the night, he had hounded her to her mother's and made promises of what he would change to have her back. Agnes had stood there, in the shadow of the tower block, with her arms folded, as her husband offered to rearrange himself so completely into whatever she wanted that he would not have been recognised by his own mother. When it was clear she wouldn't take him back, he had asked the parish father to talk with Willie and Lizzie and guilt her into returning. Agnes would not be told. She would not go back to a life she knew the edges of. For the next 3 years, Brendan McGowan had sent his money every Thursday and taken the children every second Saturday. The last thing Catherine remembered about her real father was sitting in Castellani's cafe as Brendan wiped vanilla ice cream from Leek's face. Agnes had dressed them both deliberately in the best clothes they owned, and an older lady, with pearls about her neck and ears, had complimented Brendan on their neatness and good manners. The woman leaned down to Catherine's height and asked the pretty girl what her name was. Clear as a cathedral bell, the little girl had replied,
"Catherine Bain."
Brendan McGowan had excused himself from the table then. He had wound between the clusters of happy families towards the bathroom, and then he had turned and gone out into the street. Catherine didn't know how long they had been sitting there alone, but Leek had eaten his ice cream, and then hers, and was dipping his finger into the melted dregs at the bottom of the shell-shaped glass. The good Catholic had done all he could to hold his restless wife. She had run from him, and he had lowered his pride and asked for her back. She had divorced him, and he had lowered his pride again and had taken any time he could with his children as sacred. Then she had given them the Protestant's name, and like lambs who had wandered from their field, they were sprayed with the indelible keel marks of another. Agnes had found his limit. Now, 13 years on, Leek and Catherine could not have picked him out if they met him in a crowd. Agnes had to restrain herself from picking at the brocade handle. She had packed her questions and doubts into the Catholic's cases again and cheerlessly carried them to the taxi. To look at it now, the black hackney felt like a hearse. Willie wouldn't speak to her as he helped carry the children's clothes down in the rusted lift. Lizzie stood over the big soup pot in the kitchen and wrung her chapped hands on her apron. As Agnes watched her mammy stir, she could see the gas wasn't on. Leek and Catherine had sat up in their beds at night talking about the ominous pull of this new life. Agnes could hear the low mumble of their worries through the wall. Lizzie had come to her earlier in the week and said the children had asked to stay on with her. She pleaded with Agnes to let Leek finish school and let Catherine be close to the factoring office. The day of the flit, Agnes had noticed how Leek had been gone the whole morning, slunk off with his pencils and secret books to some hidey-hole or other. Catherine had quieted her trembling lip and dutifully helped her mother pack. All morning, Lizzie hugged Shuggy close and whispered prayers for safe return into his pale neck. Agnes watched Leek when he thought no one was looking, plead to his granny again. She heard him say that he would be good, that he would behave. Agnes was glad when Lizzie rebuffed him gently.
"No, Alexander, your home is with your mammy."
As the rain started to come down, the last things to be loaded were Shug's two red leather suitcases. Only when they were stowed in place did Agnes admit to herself that it was time to go. Lizzie and Willie stood in the rain, looking as grey and stiff as the tower block behind them. Their goodbyes had been casual and distant. Lizzie wouldn't have them make a scene in public. A crack in the facade might open a rift,
and Agnes had no idea what would flood forth from that. So instead they kept busy, fussing about kettles and clean towels. Agnes sat on the back bench of the taxi with Shuggy packed between her knees. Leek and Catherine sat tight on either side, wedged amongst the boxes, their thighs pressed close to hers. She had ironed all their outfits, taking time to starch Catherine's work shirt, picking out Shuggy's blazer from the catalogue. She had bleached her dentures, and her hair was freshly dyed, a shade darker than black, closer to the saddest navy. That morning, she had tilted her head forward and asked Catherine what she thought of her new mascara. The mascara looked too heavy for her eyelids, like she was on the edge of sudden sleep. Now, as the taxi pulled out into the main road, Agnes made a show of looking back and waving mournfully through the rear window with a long, heavy blink. She thought it was a cinematic touch, like she was the star of her own matinee. The Hackney chugged up the Springburn Road and was past the empty St. Rollock's Railworks before she turned back around in her seat. She ran through the hollow reasoning why she was going along with Shug's plan. But as she tried to fortify herself with this rosary, it seemed like the stupid fancies a love-daft lassie half her age might have. Agnes rubbed the pads of her fingertips as she counted off her foolishness. The chance to decorate and keep her very own home, a garden for the Waynes, peace and quiet for the sake of their marriage. She dug deeper. There was a chance that things would be different, she hoped, once she got him farther away from his women. The windows grew foggy, and Shuggy drew a sad face in the condensation. With a flick of his thumb, Leek altered it to look like a swollen cock, and then slumped down in his seat. Agnes drew her ringed hand over the drawing and saw through the clear glass that they were passing the big blue gas containers behind Proven Mill, the guards at the northeastern gate of Glasgow. They drove for a very long time in silence. Eventually, the taxi chugged to a stop at some lights, and Shug opened the glass partition to tell them they were nearly there. He closed the glass again, and Agnes wondered whether it was from habit or something truer. She remembered when he had been courting her, how he would keep the glass open and try to charm her with his easy patter. He would lean back and wrap his Masonic ring on the divider, a faint line on his left hand where his wedding ring should be. The air would be thick with his tangy pine aftershave and hair pomade. On weekday afternoons, the taxi would smell of the sweaty stink of them, the glass misty from their lovemaking. She thought of the happy hours packed under the Anderston overpass. Happy hours, before they really truly knew one another. Agnes looked at the grassy front gardens of the low bungalows and tried to feel excited again. But it was like trying to make a fire with wet wood. There had been a line where the houses had imperceptibly passed from council to bought. Shug slid the separating window open with a swish.
Look at their gardens, huh?
The houses were beautiful, with roses and carnations and smiling ornaments behind double-glazed windows. They pulled farther along, and the houses rose above them in a raised cul-de-sac, a manicured hump elevated above the noise of the road. Each private house had a garden, which had a drive, which had a car, and sometimes even two. Agnes looked at Shug's eyes in the mirror. He had been watching her. The look felt as close to love as she could remember.
If you like this, then just wait. Joe said it's like a happy little village, a real family sort of place where everybody knows everybody else. Nicest place you could hope to live.
Leek and Catherine shared a snide, sideways glance. Agnes wrapped a hand around one of each of their knees and squeezed a firm warning. Shug shouted over the sound of the diesel engine, straining over his shoulder to be heard.
It's next a big colliery, and all the men work up at yon coal mine. The wages are good enough that the women don't even need to go out of the house for work. Joe said all their children went to the same school. Good for our Shuggy. Get him out of the sky. Have some boys his own age to play with.
His eyes were flashing happily in the mirror. He looked pleased with all his planning. Agnes watched him stroke at his moustache.
Turns out there's no pubs out here. It's bone dry, except for the miners' club.
What? Not a single one?
Agnes sat forward.
None. You need to be a miner or miner's wife to get into that club.
Agnes could feel the sweat rise in her back. What are you meant to do for fun? But Shug wasn't listening.
This is it,
he shouted, pointing in excitement to a turning on the road. The taxi tilted as Agnes and the children leaned over to see the turning that would take them to their new life. On the corner sat an empty petrol station. It had a wide forecourt, but only one pump for petrol and one for diesel. Shug slowed the taxi and turned into the street beside it. Agnes rooted around in her leather bag. There was a jangle of bingo pens and mint tins as she took out a lipstick and pulled a fresh line of blood red around her mouth. With her hand already to her mouth, she surreptitiously slipped a blue pill between her teeth, and with a single crunch, she broke it in two and swallowed it dry. Only Catherine noticed. Catherine watched her pout her lips and wipe carefully at the side of her lip line. Then Agnes reached over and adjusted the buckle on her high black heels, and with her long painted nails, she smoothed her wool skirt and picked at the ooze migrating downwards from the front of her pink angora jumper. Catherine narrowed her eyes. How come you aren't dressed for flitting?
Well, there is flitting, and then there is moving house.
Agnes spat on her comb and dragged it through Shuggy's hair. He squirmed, but she held his shoulders and kept combing until the hair sat in neat rows and she could see the clean pink lines of his scalp.
How do I look?
Asked Leek, rumpling his hair over his face. His big toe was bursting the seam of his white trainers, a dirty sock starting to poke out. Agnes sighed.
If anyone asks, you're with the movers.
They slid the windows all the way down, and the taxi filled with a rushing breeze that carried the scent of fresh-cut grass and wild bluebells. Underneath the bright green tones was a dark brown of untended fields, mounds of cow dirt, and the dark places at the bottom of wet trees. The beaded sleeves on Agnes's pink angora jumper danced in the wind, and she twinkled like a rabbit dipped in rhinestones. Shuggy reached up and ran his fingers through the glass beads. His mother's mouth was set in a wide white smile, her teeth not touching, like someone was taking a photo. She would have looked happy if her eyes hadn't kept anxiously flitting back to Shug's eyes in the rearview mirror. Shuggy sat playing with her sleeves and watched as her back molars came together and slowly started to grind back and forth. The road narrowed again, and the last of the manicured gardens dropped away for good. There was a spit of dead yew trees, and then flat, open marshlands sprang up on both sides. Small brown hillocks and clumps of brush and gorse broke the endless emptiness. Dirty copper burns snaked through the open fields, and the wild brown grass grew right up on either side of the enclosing fences, trying to reclaim the rutted track, the pit road. The road itself was covered with a settled layer of charcoal dust, and the taxi pulled lines through it as though it were the photo negative of fresh snow. The taxi shuddered around a lazy bend. In the distance lay a sea of huge black mounds, hills that looked as if they had been burnt free of all life. They filled the line of the horizon, and beyond them was nothing, like it was the very edge of the earth. The burnt hills glinted when they were struck with sunlight, and the wind blew black wispy puffs from the tops like they were giant piles of unhoovered stour. Soon, the greenish-brownish air filled with a dark, tangy smell, metallic and sharp, like licking the end of a spent battery. They curved around another corner, and the broken fence ended at a large car park. At the back of the car park sat a high brick wall with an old iron gate set into it, held tight with a heavy padlock and chain. The guard's booth at the side was tilting at a funny angle, and a thick layer of weedy grass grew on its roof. The mine was shut. Someone had painted "Fuck the Tories" on the plywood barrier. It looked like it was closed for good. Opposite the gates was a low concrete building. Dozens of men were spilling out of its windowless structure and stood in dark clumps on the pit road. At first it looked like they were leaving chapel, but as the diesel engine roared nearer, they turned as if they were one. The miners stopped their talking and squinted to get a good look. They all wore the same black donkey jackets and were holding large amber pints and sucking on stubby doubts. The miners had scrubbed faces and pink hands that looked free of work. It seemed wrong, these men being the only clean thing for miles. Reluctantly, the miners parted and let the taxi go by. Leek watched them as they were watching him. His stomach sank. The men all had his mother's eyes. The housing scheme spread out suddenly before them. Ahead, the thin, dusty road ended abruptly into the side of a low brown hill. Each of the three or four little streets that made up the scheme branched horizontally off this main road. Low-roofed houses, square and squat, huddled in neat rows. Each house had exactly the same amount of patchy garden, and each garden was dissected by the identical crisscrossing of white washing lines and grey washing pools. The scheme was surrounded by the peaty marshland, and to the east, the land had been turned inside out, blackened and slagged in the search for coal. "Is that it?" she asked. Shug couldn't answer. From the roundness in his shoulders, she could see his own heart had sunk. Agnes's back teeth were powder. As they drove towards the little hill, they passed a plain-looking Catholic chapel and a huddled group of women still with their housecoats on. Shug searched the street signs and turned the taxi a sharp right. The street was a uniform line of modest four-in-a-block houses. Four families lived in one squat block. They were the plainest, unhappiest-looking homes Agnes had ever seen. The windows were big but thin-looking, letting the heat out and letting the chill in. Up and down the street, black puffs of coal smoke came out of chimneys. The houses were incurably cold, even on a mild summer's day. Shug stopped the taxi a few houses down. He leaned over the steering wheel to get a clear look at the building. There were hardly any cars parked on the street, and the ones that were looked like they were not in working condition. While Shug was distracted, Agnes rummaged around in her black leather bag. "You three keep your mouths shut," she hissed. She lowered her head into the cavernous bag and tilted it slightly to her face. The children watched the muscles in her throat pulse as she took several long slugs from the can of warm lager she had hidden there. Agnes drew her head from the bag. The lager had washed the lipstick off her top lip, and she blinked once, very slowly, under the layers of wasted mascara. "What a shithole," she slurred. "And to think I dressed up nice for this." 1982. Pithead. Chapter 8. By the time the back doors on the Albion van were open, there were people standing in the middle of the road openly staring. They held wet tea towels and bits of half-finished ironing, things they hadn't bothered to put down in order to come and look. Families came out from the low houses and settled down on their front steps as if there was something good on telly. A tribe of sooty wains, led by a trouserless boy, crossed the dusty street and stood in a semicircle around Agnes. She politely said hello to the children, who stared back at her, rings of a red saucy dinner still around their mouths. The tight formation of the miners' houses meant the front doors faced one another.